Let's go.
Where?
To the church. But you're not going on that horse. You're coming with me.
And the cart?
What else?
I am no man to ride a cart.
And I am not a woman to attend a wedding without her husband. I can't stand it anymore.
Neither can I.
Why do you look at me like that? With thorns in your eyes.
Let's go.
I don't know what's happening, but I think. And I don't want to. Something is clear. I'm finished. But I have a son. And another on the way.
It seems that everything about Federico Garcia Lorca was extreme, from his insistence that great art depends upon a vivid awareness of death, to his association with figures on both sides of the Spanish Civil War, to his own largely mysterious murder for political or personal reasons in 1936. What can we discover about Lorca and his times from one of his most famous plays? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
What makes Lorca's plays inherently Spanish? What does he have to say about the limits of human reason? And how do his plays come across today? Our guests are many for this hour. They are Norma Saldivar, director of the recent University Theater production of Lorca's play Blood Wedding, Susan Sweeney, who played the role of the bridegroom's grudge-holding mother, Kristen Hammergren, who played the bride who is secretly in love with Leonardo, and Annalise Dickinson, who played the part of Leonardo's wife, also with us, Whitney Derendinger as the bridegroom, and Santiago Sosa as Leonardo.
Welcome to all of you to University of the Year. Let me start with you, Norma, as the director of this very strange, dark, surreal play, The Blood Wedding by Lorca. What led you to choose Blood Wedding, and what about Lorca's life is most important to know as we talk about this play?
Well, that's a complex question and one that would take, I think, an hour just to talk about why I chose it. But I will say that I've had what I think is a love and a dislike for Lorca's work that spans a long period of time.
Love and dislike.
Yeah.
Conflicted character.
I am very conflicted about his work. I find his work to be tremendously challenging and incredibly moving, and something that I would never have imagined undertaking myself. It was one of those off-limit canons. I felt that I was not ready for the longest time. I had an incredible opportunity to watch one of the, I think, the leading Lorca specialists on this continent, René Bush from Repertorio Español in New York City. His company in New York regularly does the canon, and they will go through it as many outdoor Shakespeare companies do, the Shakespeare canon, and they'll do it both in English and in Spanish. And I've always thought that to be very admirable and something that I could never tackle. However, in the recent few years, I've found myself really intrigued with this idea of violence and imminent death and what it means to be fully committed and alive in one's life. And this comes from, I think, just maturing as an artist and also as an individual experiencing life and life's tragedies. And there's something about his writing that is so profoundly clear and quite painful about the way he sees the world. It's mystical. It's violent. I love the introduction, the idea of, you know, human reason. It's unreasonable in so many ways. And this is who we are as human beings, and certainly in his point of view. So I hadn't really initially thought about Blood Wedding, but when we sat down to introduce the new class of MFAs and the opportunity to work with them came up, I thought, what might be an interesting challenge for us to undertake? Something that would allow them to be showcased on a number of different levels. And I must say that initially I didn't think of Blood Wedding because of its complexity. It's a lyrical play. It's in what I say, it's a poem in an hour and 20 minutes. But dramatizing it would certainly provide a challenge that I think would give us an opportunity to see what our group was made of. And so that became the reason, the rationale for doing it. That and also the opportunity to work with colleagues like Chris Walker from the dance program, who's a wonderful choreographer, and David Daniels, who does our fight choreography. Just the opportunity to work with a team of really wonderful directors and to bring them in for the students to work with. So for so many different reasons, it became the perfect outlet.
Well, one of the other things that Lorca said was that a play or any great art really needs to be connected to a place. And although I think this play is set technically in a place that's like Spain, it's really hard to separate it from what was going on in Spain in the early 30s when Lorca wrote this play.
I mean, yeah, I mean, I laugh because that's in the program notes. That's what we put into the program notes. I specifically asked for it to be a place that is similar to Spain. And the reason that is that we interweave all kinds of different styles of dance that are derivative of the flamenco in it. And for those who are purists, they would come and see this production or who have come to see the production would say that we weren't necessarily in Spain in the 30s. But the play is absolutely grounded and rooted in the Spanish culture and the politics of the time, in not only the political world of the time, but the gender politics of the time. So what you find is a culture, is a society that is very constrained, very strident, that is on many levels driven by bureaucracy, that is political, that is religious, that defines so many of the mores and the morals of the society, and that there is no outlet for individuality or individual passion or desire. And so in many ways, we were taking what is inherent in the play, which is how he writes poetically. He writes about where he was from and really extrapolating to think this is Spain, but not really. It could be almost anywhere that has this kind of society and government that keeps people from expressing who they are.
Before we hear the opening of the play, Blood Wedding, can I ask you, Susan, you play the mother, and we're going to hear you right at the beginning of the play. Give us some sense of this character and, you know, what has happened in her life before the play even opens.
Well, I think she's the embodiment of what Norman was just talking about. She is the old way, the society without flexibility, that there is a right way to do it, and one must be inside that or one is not appropriate. So she strongly represents that in the play. What she's been through is that her husband has been murdered by a family in this region, the Felix family, no doubt a vendetta of some kind. And most recently, her elder son has been murdered by the same family. So she is paralyzed, I would say, practically by her grief and her rage and her desire for revenge, which is what finally takes over later in the play, that she sends her remaining son off to avenge. And that is, of course, what leads to his death.
And at the opening of the play, before we hear you and the son, what is the wedding that is behind the title Blood Wedding?
A marriage has been, well, is in the process of being arranged between the remaining son and a girl at some distance away in the desert. And this is as much about class as anything. The mother is from a wealthy family. She has, since her husband's death, especially in this production that Norma has designed for us, the mother is a successful businesswoman who is maintaining the family business left after her husband was killed, which has been maintained by her sons. Now one son remains. And she is surprised at the top of the play. She hears more in the first scene about this girl, wants to know, didn't she hear that the girl had known someone else sometime back, which is, of course, important, that the son be engaging himself to a pure bride, not someone who has known someone. And, of course, we find out later that the bride has not. She has dallied, but she has not lost her virginity. The mother is a woman filled with rage and the desire for revenge.
At the same time, as we'll hear in just a moment, she says, I wish that there were no knives or anything that could puncture anybody. So I guess rather like the bride, she vacillates as far as what she wants, but she's certainly very expressive about it, getting out this conflict, this inner conflict.
Yeah, yeah. It would be so much easier if there were no weapons, but
No play if that were the case.
No play if that were the case.
So here's the opening.
Certainly no blood.
Here's the opening of Lorca's Blood Wedding.
Mother?
Yes?
I'm off now.
Where?
The vineyards.
Wait!
Need something?
No,
your meal.
That's all right. I'll eat grapes. Hand me that knife.
What for?
Why, to cut them off the vine.
A knife. A knife. God damn all knives and the bastard that invented them.
Let's change the subject.
And guns and pistols and the smallest blade and all the sickles and pitchforks in the land.
All right now.
Anything that could cut into the body of a man. A beautiful man. A man with a flower in his mouth. Who goes to his vineyards or his olive groves. His, handed down to him in patrimony.
Please, let's not...
And one day that man doesn't come home. Or rather, he does. But with a branch of palm across his breast and a dish of coarse salt in his coffin so the body won't swell in the heat. I don't know how you can carry a knife on your person. Or I keep those vipers in the house.
Are you done?
If I lived 100 years, I'd never speak of anything else. First, your father. The scent of carnations on his skin. Mine, barely 3 years. Then your brother. And is it right? Could it be that something as small as a pistol or a knife can finish a man powerful as a bull? I would never be silent. Months go by. Despair stings hot in my eyes and runs to the very tips of my hair.
Will you be done with it?
No, we'll never be done with it. Can someone bring your father back to me? Your brother? Oh, yes, and then the prison. What's a prison? They let them eat there and smoke and make music if they want to. My dead are full of grass, speechless, turned to dust. Two men, my two geraniums in bloom, and the killers in prison, alive, looking at the mountains.
Do you expect me to kill them? Is that what you want?
No. I'm just saying, I see you going through that door, and I can't help... I just don't want you carrying a knife, that's all. And I wish you wouldn't go to the fields.
Oh, come now.
I wish you were a woman. You wouldn't be going to the river now. You'd be staying with me, embroidering little puppies made of wool.
How about coming to the vineyards with me?
To the vineyards? An old crone like me? What, would you hide me under the vine leaves?
Old? Old lady? Such an old lady you are.
Your father used to take me there. Good breed that he was. Blood. Your grandfather left a son in every corner. I like that. Men should be men. And wheat, wheat.
I'm intrigued by the character of the mother. She specifically, as you hear in the opening scene, she appears to be very, very genuinely concerned about her son. And she is and remains so. But it is about, really for her, it's really about order. Is what is appropriate and what is proper. And most specifically, when we look at the roles the men and women play for her keeping her place in society, keeping her family structure in a certain order is very important. And this, the events in this play are going to be very challenging to her, most specifically her son's desire to marry. And whether he's talked to her about it in the past is one thing, but it's now become a reality for him.
When she talks about the bride-to-be, mm-hmm. as the scene continues,
yeah.
What sorts of attitudes do we see here?
Well, I think what's interesting is when, I mean, it's hard to do a play and have an audience come in and see a play that's called Blood Wedding without expecting some sort of strife and some sort of struggle. And it's not rare, the idea of a mother not wanting to give up her son to just anyone. And I think this young woman... We may initially think that this is a mother, a future mother-in-law who may just have issues with any young girl. But there's something specific about this young girl that not only the mother feels is odd or a red flag, a warning, but that there's a lot of conversation in the town. There's a lot of gossip.
When she goes to bargain, when she goes to ask for the girl's hand, it seems that there's also a lot of language about... The people in the desert don't live as well as the people near the town, and they scrabble out a living somehow in the desert, but it isn't nearly as gracious or as wealthy.
I like to call that particular scene the negotiation. It's a real business deal between the mother and her father, and it's not unheard of, but it certainly was, I would imagine, quite often the case in the 30s when you had someone who had a vineyard, who had a lot of land, and someone who had been struggling in the desert to keep that, whatever wealth they had, in the earth. There's a lot of, I think, if you listen to the play thematically, you hear a lot about human beings wanting to possess the earth, wanting to struggle and fight and dominate the earth. And this is, again, it just goes back to this unnatural need to keep things under one's power, that we as human beings want to possess, want to dominate. And I think the mother, again, it's not about her not wanting happiness for her son. It's about her wanting to be domineering about how he finds that happiness.
Well, you almost suspect that as people are so concerned about possessing land, they're also possessive of other people.
Oh, yeah. No, most definitely. There's a great line the father of the bride says about, you know, wanting to have children who will be masters over the land.
And what about me, mother?
You? What?
Do I have to tell you again?
Oh, that.
You don't approve?
No, it's not that.
So?
I don't even know myself. It's so sudden. I'm still surprised, that's all. I know she's a good girl. She is, isn't she? Works hard, makes her own bread, sews her own clothes. And I feel, somehow, when I say her name, I feel as if I'd been hit with a rock in the middle of my forehead.
Nonsense.
Oh, more than nonsense. It's just that I'll be left alone. You're all I have, and I can't bear to see you go.
You'll come live with us.
No, I can't abandon your father and your brother. I go to their graves every morning. Because if I leave and one of those killers, one of the Felix family, dies, they might bury him next to mine. And I won't have it. I won't. I would claw their rotting remains up with my own hands and hurl them against the cemetery walls.
Are you starting again?
I'm sorry. How long have you known her?
3 years. And since I was able to buy the vineyards,
Three years? Didn't she... Wasn't there someone else sometime back?
I don't know. I don't think so. Girls have to look around very carefully before they take a husband.
Yes. Well, I didn't look at anybody. I looked at your father, and when they killed him, I looked at the walls. One woman, one man, and that's that.
You know she's a good girl.
I don't doubt it. At any rate, I wish I'd known her mother.
Whatever for?
Son.
What?
Nothing. It's true. You're right. When shall I ask for her hand?
Sunday all right with you?
I'll give her my brass earrings. They're old and valuable. And you'll buy her...
Whatever you think is right.
You'll buy her some lace stockings. And for yourself, 2 suits of clothes. No, 3. You're all I've left.
I'm off. I'll see her tomorrow.
Yes. Yes, and give me 6 grandchildren to cheer me up.
6?
Or however many you wish, since your father didn't have time to leave me anymore.
The first son, for you.
Yes, but let's have some girls, too. I want to embroider and make lace and live in peace.
I know you'll love her.
I will, son. No, get along with you. You're too old for kissing. Go and kiss your wife.
I'm off.
When she is your wife.
It's just inherent in every part of the society that we explore in this play that there is a real need to keep things ordered and online, on task. There isn't much room for deviating from any kind of road. And most certainly, the bridegroom is deviating by picking a young girl that's not a local girl and that has a history.
We'll look into some of the consequences of that deviation when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
Stan Rogers made a huge impact on the North American folk scene in a very short time. I'm Tom Martin Erickson, and later today, we'll listen to some of Stan's less well-known songs and check in on a 1981 gig with his brother Garnet. Join us at 5 for Simply Folk.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach, and our guests, director Norma Saldivar, and actress Susan Sweeney, both involved with the recent production of Lorca's play Blood Wedding with University Theater. Norma as the director, and Susan played one of the major characters in the form of the mother. The character's name is just Mother. The other characters' names are bride, bridegroom, these generic names. What is Lorca up to here, do you think?
The female one, the female two.
I
think he very specifically does not give a generic name to the sort of protagonist, or the antagonist.
Leonardo gets
Leonardo
a name. That's
Felix.
About it.
I know. He gets a full name, Leonardo Felix. He has he's identifiable and specific, even though he is not of a higher class. He is of a working class part of the society. He is he's the catalyst for all things that change in this play. And so like any good reporter, in a way, he's reporting on the damage that's done by this one individual. I think the others don't have names because they are, again, archetypes. They are not specific. They could be the mother, the groom, the bridegroom, in any place. We talked earlier about it being very specifically Spanish, and that's very true. It is very Iberian in its cultural values, but it could be people anywhere. And I think if you just do any kind of investigation in the different productions of Blood Wedding, you'll find them across the world. There are several of them in the Middle East and in the Asian countries. And again, it's because of this idea that they are archetypes that can be transcend. But this Felix character is one very specific thorn that shifts and pivots everything.
At first, when I started to look at the play, it seemed like a Romeo and Juliet type family feud story. But complicating that then would be that the equivalent of Juliet, the bride, is actually in love with this married man.
Married to her cousin.
Yes, it becomes a...
Sort of in love with.
Sort of.
Yeah, she's in lust with.
In lust with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's complicated. I mean, I think it's certainly not a romantic story in that way. It is about one individual person's desire to compromise themselves and to fit in. You know, she's the square peg trying to fit into the round hole, and she's subjugated herself to her parents, to her father's will, and she feels something that she can't control. There's an emotional power there that she cannot allow herself to let go of. It's like a virus. It's a disease that she can't cleanse herself from, and she talks about that quite a bit in the language. There's the need to cleanse, to let go of, and it's in every fiber of her being. And I think for me, very specifically, that's what was appealing about the play is this inevitability. This is going to happen if we try to subjugate who we are, what our passion is, and if we don't confront it and deal with it, if we try to fit into the formula. And this, basically she lets it all hang out there in the wrong time.
We open the hour with a little bit from Leonardo and his wife. And, of course, the wife who's pregnant, confused, is sort of the untold story, too. There's, she doesn't – she's
That's
sort
a
of
– great story. It's a great story, as you say. It's never quite fulfilled, that particular story. I'm always intrigued by it. It's so – it's given such a small highlight in the play. Mm-hmm. But it's pretty potent story.
And let's hear a fuller version of the scene between Leonardo and his wife.
Let's go.
Where?
To the church. But you're not going on that horse. You're coming with me.
And the cart?
What else?
I am no man to ride a cart.
And I am not a woman to attend a wedding without her husband. I can't stand it anymore.
Neither can I.
Why do you look at me like that? With thorns in your eyes.
Let's go.
I don't know what's happening, but I think. And I don't want to. Something is clear. I'm finished. But I have a son. And another on the way. She's leaving white and pure as a star. That's how I left my house. That day I felt I was carrying the entire field in my arms.
All right. Let's go.
With you?
Yes. Start walking, then.
Santiago, as far as playing Leonardo, is he more than just this kind of dashing figure who literally sweeps this woman off on horseback?
I think he's probably more the paradigm of angst and the result of a broken heart. I think it's the deep inner feelings is very heightened throughout the play and is very much displayed through his actions.
For some reason that I'm not sure we're really familiar with, he has married, apparently against his will, before the play starts.
More of a consolation prize, I think. He couldn't get what he wants, so he took something. Whatever came his way, he was like, okay, well,
and
take that.
Couldn't live with that decision, though.
Not so much, no.
And what do you see as your relationship to your wife when you're in the scene that we heard you in? How do you regard her?
Very cordial and calm and collected as much as can possibly be, I think. He's in a situation that he can't really get out of, so he's doing the best that he can, but he's on the inside, I think he is exploding with all of these things that want to get out, and I think there's a lot of desire to break and destroy things and burn stuff down. He's got all that going on, but he's kind of locked in.
That actually touches on something that's kind of a leitmotif in this play that we get from the mother as played by Susan Sweeney, and it turns up in her very last line, too. She's talking about this dark living root of a scream that wants to get out. That seems to kind of run in this particular group of people.
Yeah, definitely inner monsters living deep inside of a lot of the characters in this play. And Leonardo is definitely one of those with heavy heart.
That scene between Leonardo and his wife sounds fairly realistic, but not all the play is like that. Some of it's very weird.
No, well, that's exactly why the play is frightening, I think, for so many of us who are directors to tackle. And why I, when I said earlier that I had that sort of like and dislike about it, is that it's not a clean play in that it's all one style. The first two acts feel very realistic, and the third act takes a complete detour to a surrealistic place. So one of the things that I tried to do with production was to marry those two things together. And I've divided the play into three sections, the first section being the introduction. So we've created a prologue that is all dance and then integrated smoothly, trying to seamlessly go from reality to non-reality in the first section, where the neighbors suddenly become the voice of the community and are represented as fate and as part of the mother's anxiety about what's happening with her son. So they're represented on stage. And we tried to do that not only by dividing up the one character, which is the neighbor's character, into three voices, three women played that role, but also what we do with it stylistically, visually. And then we come to this section, which is where the scene that we just heard is from, which is, I think, the most realistic. And I don't know, we tried very hard to look at how we brought any kind of stylized action to that section. But that's one of the most realistic sections before we go into the third act, which is completely surreal.
And how do you see Lorca's relationship to Dolly and others as somehow coming across in the play?
Well, we're working from a translation adaptation by Lillian Groag, who, of all people I have known, would understand what Lorca was trying to do with language. And when you read this version in English, you realize that you're moving quite swiftly sometimes from language that sounds almost realistic, except things like verb tenses don't match, or a big, fat, awkward, poetic image pops up in the middle of a line. Or there's so many things that are unusual about this that made memorizing tricky, because you want to do the best you can to speak what is there on the page, but it doesn't jam in your brain quite as easily as it does when you read it. And then you go into full out, full tilt boogie, poetic scenes where the lines are written in verse. The scene between Leonardo and the bride at the end before the murders is poetic. It's in stanzas. And it's very different from their first scene. These things are so lovely and so tricky for actors and directors to find the through line of a piece. So what Norma was saying about trepidation, I think we all felt. Where does this sit?
Yeah, it's so interesting to find a balance. And It's very Shakespearean in that way. Mm-hmm. When they go to the woods, something magical happens.
Like a summer night's dream. Yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So again, going back to that theme of wanting to possess and be powerful over the earth, to dominate the earth. Once they are in the woods, they are dominated by what goes on.
And in the background of that scene are death and the moon.
Mm-hmm. I think his work as a poet really comes through is that he's not afraid to personify the moon. Mm-hmm. And if you look culturally at Latin culture, you see that there is a lot of strong imagery in our cultural understanding of the world. And the moon is given this incredible character, these characteristics of wanting blood, really wanting something back in return, being cold and wanting to be warmed by blood. And as soon as you hear those words, you know that it's not going to end happily.
And the language is very, her language is very longing.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And then death is there, and they work together in tandem to bring Leonardo and the bride together with the groom who has been chasing the bride in the woods.
And it seems there's this world with the moon and the all kinds of surrealistic things. But then we also have a wedding, you know, a wedding reception, guests with all kinds of things. Can
right.
you talk, Susan, about the scene at the wedding between you and your son, the groom, and sort of foreshadowing of things perhaps not going so well?
What has happened prior to this scene is that the two are married now, and the mother overhears the end of a conversation they have where it's very clear to her that things are not well and that she's got to find out about this. She wants to know if her son is happy. She wants to know if the bride is happy. And then what ensues is the directive about how to treat your wife when your wife is being skittish or distant. She's a determined character. She's going to do her best at every moment to make sure that he knows the right way to do it.
So here's Susan Sweeney as the mother and Whitney Darren Dinger as the bridegroom.
Son?
Where have you been?
In the midst of all that noise. Are you happy?
Yes.
And your wife?
Taking a little rest. Bad day for brides.
Bad? It's the only good one. I felt as if I'd inherited a fortune. It's the turning over of fresh earth, the planting of new trees.
Are you leaving?
Yes. I need to be home.
Alone?
Not alone. My head is full of things and men and strife.
There is no longer any strife.
There is strife as long as there's life.
You know, I will obey you always.
Be warm towards your wife. But if you notice her distant or skittish, caress her a little roughly. A tight embrace, a little bite, and then a soft kiss. Not enough to make her angry, but to let her feel you're the male, the master, the one who gives orders. That's how I learned from your father. And since you no longer have one, I'm the one to teach you these things.
I will always do as you say.
Whitney, you have been dismissed by your wife in this play at one point as being really kind of a lightweight. How do you take that?
Well, it sort of hurts. I think the bridegroom is, in some respects, sort of a man without a home. He's trying to do everything that he personally feels that he should do. He's trying to stay true to his family and to make his mother proud. And those pressures are really conflicting with what he personally would like to do, sort of a changing of the guard between the old style of justice and the old way of living versus this new society that not everyone is able to find a spot in. And so I think the bridegroom he's in a tricky situation because in his mind, he's gone through the proper motions, he's jumped through every hoop, and finally, great, now I'm ready for a life of happiness, and it never has a chance to survive because of so many outside forces saying what a marriage and what a relationship should be, that the individuals in the relationship are often lost with the larger idea of a relationship.
Is this a story about the conflict between what might be called an arranged marriage and a marriage for love?
Yeah, yeah, in certain respects. If you are marrying to improve your status in society, if you're marrying because it's financially beneficial to both families versus taking the time to find someone you love. It's also the idea of being in love with an idea as opposed to being in love with a person. And so here comes along this beautiful girl, and it only makes sense that her family and mine should be joined. And I don't think either of them really took the time to get to know the people that would be involved in the relationship. And that's where I think the downfall starts to spring from.
Your mother in the play gives you lots of talks about what it means to be male, to be the master, et cetera.
Yeah.
Do you
yeah.
play yourself as sort of one who's in search of a masculine identity?
Yeah, there are several shoes that I think the bridegroom has to fill. His father was killed. His older brother was killed. And so all of a sudden he is the last of the line. And he's trying to uphold all of those ideas. But he's never had that time to find himself. And so there's a lot that's put upon him in that regard.
We'll find out what happens to the bride who runs away with her previous love interest, not the groom, when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
Many Wisconsin Public Radio programs are saved for later listening at WPR.org. So when you want to hear a program again, or you'd just like to listen when you want to, visit WPR.org and click on Audio Archives.
Blood Wedding is the Macbeth of Lorca's plays, not produced very often, and when it is, almost always unsatisfactorily. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't try. That's from a review in Curtain Up of a London performance of Lorca's play, Blood Wedding. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland, and our guests are many. We have with us Norma Saldivar, the director of the University Theater recent production of Blood Wedding, also Susan Sweeney, who played the mother, Whitney Derringer as the bridegroom, Kristen Hammergren as the bride, Annalise Dickinson as Leonardo's wife, Santiago Sosa as Leonardo. Well, this play, if it's the Macbeth of Lorca's plays, I'm not sure what that means other than that we know there are going to be a lot of dead bodies, a lot of vengeance, a lot of blood up there on the stage. Norma, do you want to comment about that?
It reminds me of a British version of Bernarda Alba that I saw many years ago. And I was, you know, this is in no means a reflection of the actresses. They were quite wonderful actresses in their own right. But there's something about his plays that are just so difficult. And this one is especially difficult, which I think is the reason we all sort of shy away from doing them. They're very hard. It's hard to come into a play that has a title like Blood Wedding, that's a tragedy, and that is so foreign to us culturally, especially a contemporary audience. It's very difficult for a contemporary audience, young people specifically, to come in and look at a play that really says something about a time period that's so foreign to them. And when men were men and women were women, so to speak, as I think the mother says in the play, and that the women really hold a particular office in these families where they're responsible for not only nurturing and raising the children, but in some ways, you know, keeping the legacy of the family alive if the family dies, as they do in this.
Burying all those dead men, that's one of their roles.
It's exactly true. And that's, you know, when we think of, I sort of like to think of this as more of a Hamlet. There are a lot of dead bodies at the end of this play.
Well, if it's an allegory with characters who are named bride and bridegroom and mother, then what exactly do you think the message is?
Well, I think one of the messages that Norma was intent upon having the production deal with at the end of this production, the women all came forward. There's a long section at the end that is all in verse, and it's very liturgical in feel, repetitive. The same images come through again and again, and she's got several women speaking them, led by the mother, and it's spoken to the audience. So one of the messages, at least in our production, was violence begets violence. It's never over. It only takes a tiny little knife to do it, something that doesn't even fit the grasp of your hand. And there is a kind of consciousness raised, I hope, at least the way we were trying to do it. In these times, perhaps in any times, what a good thing to do, to have the audience be left with it in their laps.
Is the stress, in terms of the staging and the way the play is written, is the stress mostly on the psychological reaction to these things rather than people actually getting skewered on stage?
Well, the play does not have, as written, does not include the killing of the gentleman. But we've chosen to bring violence on the stage because it is so much a part of what we do in the world right now in terms of film and television and on stage. Violence on stage is dramatic, and it emphasizes in a way that words about something happening off stage don't. And so I very specifically chose to bring some of that violence onto the stage, not a completed violence.
Yeah.
So the fight, which is David Daniel's work, and with his assistance, we orchestrated a very specific arc to this violence so that we would see the engagement of these two men coming together like Lorca would have in a bullfighting ring, and that what we don't see is the actual kill. It was important for us to be left with a question as to who was dead, so that when the women came together at the end to mourn the dead, that they would tell us and inform us that it was actually both men. To me, the violence is so important for us to see it, and specifically because the playwright understood it. He wrote about it in all of his poetry about bullfighting. He understood the delicateness of human life and how quickly it could go, how quickly it dissipates. And so he expresses that, I think, really quite beautifully at the end of this play. And he asks us to consider how significant life is and how easily it can be snuffed out, which is, again, if we think about the great writers, we think of Shakespeare, and he says it so eloquently in his writing. And so I think that this is why Lorca is, he's the master writers of his culture. And I think of any theatrical culture, he's just an amazing writer. He can understand the human condition in a way that's pretty profound.
Well, that bullfighting analogy really does make sense, doesn't it? Not just because it's a Spanish play, of course, but because it's so much about ritual. Mm-hmm. And that
Absolutely.
On the surface, this may be horrifying and irrational.
Right.
And yet we go through this ritual on a routine basis.
Absolutely. And we worked, when David Daniel and I met, we met very briefly, and that's all really we needed. And I said to him, this is really about creating this animalistic ritual of bringing together these two men in the clearing. In a clearing, if you could imagine, in the woods, lit beautifully by the moon to meet their inevitable end. And it shouldn't be two human beings. It should be two animals coming together. And David did some wonderful research on how animals attack and how they devour their prey and how they devour each other when they're equally matched. So all of that was played into in that particular moment. And again, the conclusion was less important than the act of coming together in violence, because the conclusion is really not about the moment of death, but rather what's the resonance of what's left afterwards, who has to clean it up, so to speak.
One interesting aspect of the performance to me is the approach to sexuality, especially with the bride, who is in many ways sort of aggressive, has lots of lust and sensual thoughts, but ends up virginal.
Right. Well, and I think that's ironic in so many ways, because mm-hmm. traditionally, when we think about the female, they're thought of archetypally as mother or this sexualized being. And so she is truly sexualized. Unfortunately for her, she has no way of fulfilling that.
She's 0 for 2.
Yeah, exactly. not a good thing for her. She loses both of them at the end. Yeah, yeah. So the sexuality it's just brimming always. The mother talks about it in that first scene that mm-hmm. we heard as well. There's no fear about talking about sexuality as long as it's within the constraints of what's appropriate and proper. I would question whether that was a proper thing for the mother to bring up at that particular moment. But
going in the fields with the father.
Yes,
and, so
and bringing
on.
That up to her son. I always brought a little shiver to her.
Tradition aside, that mother does have a mind of her own.
She does.
She's an unstoppable force
yes.
of nature in her own
yeah.
right.
And in some ways, it's a cyclical play. what starts at the beginning ends at the end.
Yes.
And so we see the bride at the end joining in with the other women who are mourning, Leonardo's wife and the mother specifically. And in some ways, she has taken over that role. So it is, as Susan says, it's just this endless cycle that happens, that can happen. And I think that the play really does question whether it should continue.
Is this the kind of thing that Lorca did more than once, or is this play really out there on its own as far as his other pieces?
Well, I think stylistically, for me, this play is out there on its own. This one has a difficulty and a challenge in it when we jump to surrealism. I mean, he was a good friend of Dali and Buñuel, and so he was writing stylistically in a time which was really provocative. But when you look at other plays like Bernarda Alba or Irma, you see similarities in the characters. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't mm-hmm. you say, Susan?
Well, and similarities first and foremost in that how many women there are cycling through this same thing.
Yeah.
Loss and death.
Yeah. And a lot of imagery in all of them, right, of the earth and just
blood,
different symbols.
Yeah.
Most definitely. Most definitely.
And the laurel tree and,
If you read his poetry, you find that he draws on these same themes over and over again. The exception that I found were his New York poems when he was in New York and he wrote about the city and he just felt displaced and not at all happy, very much the foreigner in the United States. But if you look at, there are a lot of strong ties that bring you. In rehearsal, I would say to Susan, this is Bernarda Alba here. This is the same character. Bernarda Alba begins with a funeral of the loss of a father, and Bernarda Alba saying that these women will be in mourning for an extended period of time, mm-hmm. close the doors, close the windows, all of this, and they will mourn alone. And you have a younger daughter who wants out and is in love with her older sister's fiancé and takes the wrong turn. So it's, again, very similar. There's always one young woman who is incapable. So the final scene that you'll hear today is a Leonardo and bride scene, and this takes place in the woods. We know that the bridegroom's mother has encouraged him to go after the bride and to bring her back. And so he has taken a group of men, and he is searching through the woods for his bride, and we fall upon Leonardo and the bride.
Quiet.
I'll go on from here, alone. Go. I want you to turn back.
I said be quiet.
With your teeth, with your hands, with anything. Tear from my honest neck the metal of this chain and leave me in a corner of my house all made of earth. And if you won't kill me now as you'd kill a tiny snake, place in my bride's pure hands the cold barrel of your gun.
We took the step, now hush. Because they're coming up fast, and you're coming with me.
You will have to force me, then.
Force you? Who ran down the stairs first?
I did.
Who reined the horse?
I did,
and true. What hands fastened my spurs?
These, your hands now, which at the sight of you would crush the blue branches and murmur of your veins. I love you. I love you. Step aside. I would kill you if I could and wrap you in a shroud edged in violets for my grief. Oh, what a cry! What fire rages through my head!
What glass splinters in my tongue. Because I tried to forget you and put a stone wall between your house and my own. It's the truth. Remember? And I saw you from afar and I threw sand up to my eyes. But I rode my horse that night and the horse went to your door. And my blood turned black in a dream of silver pins and in my sleep I planted poison herbs into my flesh. Not my doing. It's the earth and the scent that flows so freely from your hair and from your breasts.
This is madness. I don't want a bed or bread with you, but there's no minute of the day I don't crave to be beside you. Because you pull me and I follow, and if you push me, back I come again like a blade of wind-blown grass. I have left a stern man and his family and friends in the middle of our wedding with the wreath still on my head. They will punish you alone, and I don't want it to be so. Leave me here. Run! You have no one on your side.
Morning birds are breaking with the sun across the treetops. The night lies slowly dying on the stone edge of the wood.
Let us go back to that dark place where I will always love you, where the world means nothing, nor its poison, nor its blame.
And I will sleep at your feet to guard your dreams every night. Naked, facing the fields like the bitch in heat I am, as your beauty brands my flesh.
Fire with fire burns, and the same small flame will destroy two blades of wheat. Let's go.
Where are you taking me?
Where those after us can't go, and I can look at you once more.
No. From fair ground to fair ground for an honest woman's sorrow, for the world at large to gawk at me with my wedding sheets still flying like white banners in the wind.
If I thought the way one must, I should want to leave you now. But I go where you go. And you too. Take one step. Try. Moonlight nails have cleaved forever your wide hips tight to my waist.
Kristen, let me ask you about the character you play, the bride. Central, confusing, complex character. Tell us how you see her and what you have to do to play that part.
Well, how I see her. I see her as someone who is lacking some significant guidance and is wrestling with this problem of what she feels inside and what the outside world is telling her to do. And she lacks this figure of a mother to guide her and ends up, you know, sort of, I guess, messing everything up in this world. But it's a world that's faulty. It's a society that is unnaturally rigid, and she can't survive in it because she has this element of natural to her. There's kind of a contrast between, like, I think of it as like the city and then like her world out in the desert that's a little bit freer. And the way that I approach it, you know, that's been the interesting thing going through it. It changes every night. Like, how do you play someone with so much inner conflict and someone who I found at first hard to find the sympathy for, especially in the sympathy for her situation, but in the scenes in the play, there's not a lot of sympathy comes out. You know, how do you make the bride likable in some way so that people aren't just totally blaming her at the end?
She's not terribly sympathetic to either of the men in her life either.
Right. Everyone has some sort of finger to point at her, and she's, you know, in this endless struggle to be true to herself.
You'd like to say, well, break out of this and you know, live long and prosper, but that doesn't exactly work either, does it? I mean, if he's saying we have to break out of this mold, he's not really making it look very appealing.
Mm. Well, I would say that some of this had to have been his own anxiety about who he was as an individual. And most writers are writing from their own place, from where they know. And he had a lot of conflict in his life and his sexuality and his homosexuality and in a time and a place that would be frightening to allow himself to express himself fully. I think that plays a great deal. Exactly. Exactly. That plays a great deal in all of the plays that he writes.
The name of this particular play is Blood Wedding. It was recently produced by University Theater, and it is definitely an indicator that it's worth delving further into the works of the playwright Lorca, who was a fascinating person writing in a very difficult time. Thank you for joining us, Susan Sweeney and Norma Saldivar.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And thanks also to our cast members who are with us this hour. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.